It's October 26, 1997. We're in Austin, Texas. You were explaining about the reasons why the National Congreso, the apparatus for the party at the national level, did not succeed.
Mm-hmm. At that time, I guess the only states participating were Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, and California. And and from my what I remember, you know, at the meetings, I think we were each state was struggling to maintain its organization, but I think also in California, the participation of the party had definitely also dwindled. In Arizona, también. And so it just didn't have the momentum that it had in previous years, in which there were actually, you know, you could say success in political elections. And I guess the major issue or element was that as political parties, they had already run their, as an organization, as a organization, had almost ran its course, and the times were changing, and people were already looking for the other options besides Razón Unida. And I think that was true across each of the states, and I think Texas probably still had the most political activity. I mean, the strongest political activities happening still at that time, in terms of what was going on within, you know, particular county or particular areas, but overall everything was changing, and in most cases, we had just not elected the candidates that there had been hopes for, and I think in that discussion, we were looking at a way to organize the national, but we didn't have the foundation or the base at the state to continue, and I think pretty soon we all saw that. We were not going to be able to go. We were there meeting, but it was very few, and we really didn't represent, you know, great numbers of people that were actually spending time to discuss what any even national issues. I mean, I think everybody was just trying to survive at a local level and trying to deal with what was happening within, you know, within a county or within a city, and we weren't ready for a national. We didn't have any clear leadership nor any clear direction at that time. I mean, I felt like we were struggling to try to define that, but it was just not happening.
The community in Robstown, did you go visit that community?
I know we did go visit that community. Let's see, it was during... was it during Mario's? No, it wasn't. It was right after right before the campaign, which they did have some wins, and I don't remember what time that was. It must have been during. It must have been during the first time Ramsey ran. Yeah.
What about in Frio County, Pearsall, the beatings of Modesto Rodriguez, did you go investigate all that? Can you tell us all about that?
We did. Yes, we went to Pearsall, and guys, I should have written my notes. We should have written this.
It will be transcribed.
Yeah, but, and I hope somebody else remembers the details. I know that he'd gotten beaten up in Pearsall, it was, and I don't even remember the provocation, but I know he was having problems with some land, and that there were some back taxes on the land, and they were trying to, and also he was going to run. I think he was going to run in the, ay, uncle, this is embarrassing.
Well, no, if you don't remember. I mean,
no, I don't remember. All I remember is that he had been severed.
Well, but you went down there.
Yes, yes.
What did you find out, or what did you do?
Well, I mean, gosh, I can't remember.
Okay,
I right, cannot all right. remember.
All right, well, we won't push that one. All right, so the party ended.
Right.
Mario did not obtain sufficient votes, so we were decertified. We were removed off the ballot for the proximate elections. So what did you do to close up shop, or did you? Or what happened?
Well,
and what records did you keep? I mean, I was shocked when you said they're right there in terms of those tapes.
The tapes there.
Because I know you made a deposit of when you were county, but I mean, what happened to all the records of the party afterwards? The ones you had and stuff.
I think I made another donation afterwards to the
library.
Library, right.
Uh-huh. UT.
Right.
Austin.
Mm-hmm. And I think I think also Marta helped just facilitate that. Uh-huh. So all the records were.
Did you go to any meetings to discuss what we should be doing next, or would you just everybody just go home?
Everybody pretty much just went home, right? There was just not much after that meeting after the election. It was pretty much no one was attending the meetings. I mean,
what meeting after the election?
I mean, the state meetings after the election.
You called some meetings?
We met up through. Yeah, I think our last functions really was our participation at the national with Juan Jose Peña. You know, when he called the meetings, and that was probably the
but
last.
But that's
function.
The national.
Right. Mine. I mean, but that as an entity, that was probably our last functions as a.
Well, then let me switch over. I remember that many people reacted to all of that in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the easiest way of saying it is many of them just went and hid themselves and just closed that the door to the public. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And some are just beginning to emerge from all of that. In your case, I think I remember that you continued your ideological and philosophical movement to the left.
Mm-hmm.
That you started going to Cuba and you started traveling and becoming very enamored with the socialist agenda. These are my words.
Mm-hmm.
But so what did you do right after the party, and is this correct? Did you start traveling and doing things?
I think, yes. I mean, I went to the, I'd always wanted to go to Cuba. And even the time that the party went, when you went. And the group went. I had wanted to go to Cuba. I think Bobby and Johnny from Austin went, and he was the only one that was able to go. But I think in my mind, I had always wanted to be there and visit and see for myself what the whole movement or revolutionary process was. And so I went to the youth festival.
What year?
Must have been 78, because I think I was
79.
79 was that was the.
Oh, that's the Cali Fest.
Right, but the year before that, I had gone to the World Youth Festival, and at that time when I went, Paul Velez and I went were two people that went from Austin, when I was there. The people from the Mercedemos Brigade. I met some of them. Jackie Ramos from Pennsylvania, from Philadelphia, and she said that they were wanting to have a recruit from different parts of the nation, and that the Mercedemos Brigade explained their organization was an organization that assisted people to go to Cuba. And And so she asked me if I would be interested in helping them in doing that type of work. And I told them I would be, and that I would consider that there were people in Austin that wanted to come to Cuba but had not had, you know, a forum or a way to go there. So I guess about a couple of years later, then I started working with the Method Amish Brigade, helping them recruit, and during the interviews and during the paperwork for the organization. And I worked with the Method Amish Brigade probably for maybe 8 years, I think.
So how many times did you go to Cuba?
I think I've probably been there at least 5 times. Yeah.
When was the last time?
The last time was probably 91, 92.
Mm-hmm. What changes did you see in Cuba and the experiment with the voto popular of participating, mm-hmm. and they have their democracy?
There was a peak in which I saw the Cuban Revolution, which it was at its height, I guess. And it must have been, I guess I was there in 79, so I must have been there maybe at the 80s, early 80s. When I felt like there was just a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of renewal, a lot of hope. And I think that began to change, and I saw big changes the last time I was there. I was beginning to see people not very happy with the work situation, complaints about a lot of surveillance, a lot of personal surveillance, a lot of mistrust, people checking up on other people, and that type of energy that was that got to the people, you know, to the neighborhood, that made it very uncomfortable for people. There was a lot of scarcity of commodities, you know, soap and toothpaste and that type of thing. The lines for bread were getting longer and longer at that time. I think the wheat cuts in the wheat coming in from the Eastern Bloc. So I was beginning to see already, I think, erosion of the enthusiasm and the hope that I had seen, even 5 years before.
Do you think that's because the United States policy is working, or because the communistic model is weak?
I don't think there's ever a foul-proof social system. I think that all social systems go through processes. In my mind, there is probably no way that a country like Cuba could have gone through all the changes that it went through without that kind of revolutionary impetus. I mean, there's no way that it could have changed all it changed. I think when one looks at Cuban history and what they were before the revolution and what they became, were two different, you know, societies. I mean, for everyone across the board, from color to gender to sex, I mean, there was changes in the family and family relationships. So something like that is, you know, is just, there are just too many changes to say that it's the fault of, you know, of systems. Something happened there, and it was definitely a very viable, very vibrant kind of changes. But I think with Cuba was isolated, and definitely I think that was a major detriment to Cuba. The fact that they had no other Latin American neighbors outside of Mexico that really had that kind of contact with Cuba and maintained it. Of course, the U.S. put a lot of pressure on many countries, you know, to sever the relationship. But I think Cuba was pretty well isolated from the world, other than the Eastern Bloc. And once that was cut, I mean, they really found themselves in great isolation. Definitely, the way that this country has dealt with Cuba is definitely at I think a disgrace, simply because Cuba is such a small, small country compared to, you know, what the U.S. Is and can do, and the kind of economic stranglehold that it has on Cuba is just ridiculous, given the fact of the size and the power that this country has. And to deny any group of people even just basic medical supplies, I think is truly inhumane. But I see that there should have been changes within the system long before. You know, I don't think it's healthy for any one person to stay in power as long. Most of the youth that had been born after the revolution were totally different entities and human beings, and they didn't understand pre-revolutionary conditions. They had no connection. They have no ties to Fidel. They do not understand him. And so I think that all that ideology loses its flavor, loses its sense, loses its connection to people that are born afterward that have not gone through that, you know, through those changes. So it becomes out of touch with the majority of the people. And I thought that's what I saw, especially among the youth, that they just could not relate to the party in power. So it's hard for me to say because I don't think there's ever a perfect social structure that is going to be able to address. And I think we all strive to create that perfect structure, but I think just organizations or the structures, by the fact that they exist and human beings try to run, automatically almost excludes some sector. I mean, I don't think you can ever have a perfect social structure, although I think we all hope that we could create one.
Do you think the Cuban model is going to end with Castro?
I think the model is dead, because I don't think it addresses, I don't think it includes everyone already.
Okay. I noticed sitting here that you seem to have developed in another direction, and that's a big spiritual activity and endeavor, and some of the language you used this evening suggest that. So what are you exploring and developing now?
I think that that for me, my search continues. Yet I think I'm connecting with my roots in another way, and the heritage that I think was lost is that of the spiritual healing coming from a curandera, or coming from a curandero, that part of healing, although I didn't have it directly experienced it in my childhood, because of where we grew up, we didn't really have a community per se. But as I've traveled in Mexico, and I've seen many of my friends go through very debilitating diseases like cancer and lupus and AIDS, you know, we're facing, you know, an issue, a health issue, and for many people that I've watched grapple with those diseases as they approach death, and for all the experiences that I've had with, you know, friends of mine that have died of AIDS, there was the need of some of my friends going through that process of wanting to know what they needed to do spiritually to cross over, to go to the spirit world, and how do they connect. And I think those were the questions that started surfacing with me as I approached death myself, is how does one prepare for death? And And I think that a lot of times, as I begin to hear different curanderas that I visited in Mexico, and for them, you know, the work is working with the plants and working within a community and working with those that are around them, and providing that assistance at the spiritual realm, and I think that's where I started to see my role and my calling as to what I would do and what I would, how I would assist.
Where in Mexico have you been traveling for this?
In Oaxaca, in Oaxaca, Oaxaca, as well as up in the Mazateca area.
Is that where the flooding occurred in all this just recently?
No. This was in a small community just south of Oaxaca, and then Mazateca is up in the it's in the northern part of northeastern part of Oaxaca, and then there was another curandera that came to visit from the state of Guerrero near Cuernavaca.
Oh, you brought them over here?
A couple of them have come over here, and some we have visited in Mexico.
Are you incorporating this in your curriculum in the school, or?
No, not at this time.
Can you just bring them out of your expense personally to come to your house?
Oh, no. It's a group that we brought them, and they did actual talleres here for the public.
Oh.
Oh, we invited.
Well, who's this group?
What's
it called?
It's a loose group. It was partly done through La Peña, which is an arts and cultural group. And then friends of La Peña, basically people that are beginning to explore these avenues, Daniel Yanes, and it's not really an organization other than we've just kind of worked through our connections through La Peña.
In the Latin American tradition, what does La Peña mean?
It is a word that has its origin in Chile, and it was. Of course, it means the rock, literally. But the other word, the way that's used in La Peña, were gatherings of people to share music, to share political views, to share information. And the word La Peña came from that those gatherings that were organized in Chile for the purpose of sharing cultural as well as political information.
During Allende?
Yes, and
or
prior.
Sure after?
Right, prior to Allende. I think it's been in use for several years, probably all the time, during the time that the whole New Movements song started. And then, of course, it was used in Berkeley, California. There was a big group called La Peña. And then Cynthia Perez, who went to school at Berkeley, had an experience to see it there. So she decided to call La Peña, an organization, an arts organization. And so the organization basically promotes Chicano art and cultural events.
Yeah, this group emanates out of that restaurant that they own, the three sisters, mm-hmm. Cynthia and what's the other one?
And Lydia.
Lydia.
Mm-hmm.
These are cousins to Henry Cisneros, no?
They're sister-in-laws.
Sister-in-laws.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Are they in any way connected to Amado Peña and his whole entrepreneurial
no.
business?
Or? No. Mm-hmm.
Is he involved?
No.
Mm-hmm. He used to be involved.
He has donated in the past to different efforts, but no, he's not. He's never been involved in the actual board or the organization of La Peña here.
But he used to be involved in the Raza Unida party. You
know,
moved here.
Uh-huh.
And worked closely with, you know, and mm-hmm. How did he gravitate away or what happened?
Well, I know that he was, you know, active and I remember in the first campaign. And during the first campaign, he did donate several of his art pieces, you know, for different auctions and that type of work. But I think he helped us with t-shirts. That I think that first year we did a lot of the t-shirts there with, and also Luis Guerra helped us. He felt us.
I think the entire my organization in Raza Unida learned silk screening from Amado.
Amado, that's true. and then he continued, you know, in his venture, and just continued his artwork, and has continued to help students get scholarships. He has a scholarship program that he sponsors.
Is it true that he donated the land for Juarez Lincoln?
That I don't know.
No?
I don't know.
His former wife, no, Mercedes, mm-hmm.
Peña,
is still here, and
yes,
the children are still here. No, mm-hmm. Of course they're grown.
Yes, they're all grown. They're musicians and interested in music. Yes, Chepito has a band. Yeah, and Mercedes is actually a well known artist herself now, and does her work, a very folk work, folk art, and has done well, I think.
Okay. Well, let's pick up a piece that we left off. We left you in San Antonio doing your master's. I guess you finished it. You also did work to get certified as a teacher, and I guess you did that.
Mm-hmm.
And you came to Austin and you became a teacher. Tell me a little bit about your career there and where it is now.
Okay. I've worked almost pretty much exclusively bilingual and English second language education. That's been the focus of most of my work in public education. I went back and also got supervision certification, and so I, from the classroom, I moved into administration programs, and so I've been working as in central office as instructional coordinator for bilingual and English second language programs. And I'm coming pretty much to the close of my career, I think, probably retiring in a couple of years.
Why?
To start my second career.
Which is?
Which is of some type of spiritual healing and work within that realm. Yeah, so.
Philosophically, where are you on this bilingual education debate? Should we concentrate more on ESL approaches, or should we have a maintenance type of bilingual program
where kids I think all human beings can become multilingual and multicultural. And to me, that is the answer. If we're going to learn to live in this world without killing each other and without destroying the earth, hopefully, I think we need to learn many cultures and many languages. I think Europe has definitely, I mean, if you go travel in Europe, most public schools in the European system teach more than one language. And I was in Greece this summer, and many of the people there spoke four languages. So I don't see, and actually some of the research bears out that people that are multilingual and multicultural, cultural, actually tend to have an edge in intellectual ability, just simply because I think they're more flexible. There's a flexibility of thought and also being able to see different perspectives. And I think that's true for most of us that have had the privilege of being bicultural and bilingual. You begin to understand things from various points of view, and you begin to be able to stretch your thinking, simply because you have to consider the contradictions within within two cultures or. And so you begin to integrate more, to I think accept more, and to be a little bit more open, and probably more creative and problem solving. So I think there's definitely advantages to being multilingual and multicultural.
Well, how do you describe the program you've developed here at Austin Independent School District?
We've struggled. We've struggled continuously. I just got back from the Texas Association Bilingual Conference in Houston this past weekend. And in Austin, we still have a lot to do. Not all our children are successful yet. But I think conferences are for that purpose. You begin to share and understand what other people are doing. And I think definitely Isleta is one of those districts that have definitely have shown that our children can learn very effectively. And they've pretty much embraced dual language instruction, which is...
teaching both languages forever.
Right.
So like a maintenance program.
So their mission is that any graduate from Isleta, by the time they graduate from high school, will be bilingual, biliterate. Biliterate, not just bilingual, but there's the whole issue of literacy. And so for me, that's the answer. And that's where we need to go in from.
Well, how close or how far are you here in Austin?
Here in Austin, we're very far from that. Yeah, we're still...
So are we talking about a program where you do 45 minutes and then quit by the second grade?
We have a couple of projects in which we're doing dual language, in which there's been some Title VII funding, federal funding, to initiate that program. We're hoping to get other projects funded and other schools now that are talking about providing a dual language program. And to me, that's where the answer is. If we stay within the state guidelines only, which is basically a compensatory program, one that that allows you to use the native language just long enough until the child is ready to transition into total English, it's a transitional program that, you know, that doesn't really support what the research is saying and that is to the benefit of the child, and that is a dual language program, which you're actually developing literacy in two languages and for an extended period of time. So that's, you know, our hope. I mean, our hope, my hope in the last 2 years that I have left is that we will be able to, to win or to change attitudes of people, because I think people are still, even people in the field, are still questioning the soundness of bilingual education, and especially within the realm of the initiative, the initiative in California, and past experiences in, you know, like in Proposition 187 and others, that people still are saying that it's better and it's worthwhile to only teach one language, and the insistence of being only a single language, you know, society. But I think, you know, the struggle is ever present. I mean, it's a daily struggle, you know, with everyone trying to convince him that it's a worthwhile venture and that we can be successful with our students.
Are more Spanish-speaking parents approaching you, telling you that they want their kid to speak only English and not be in bilingual?
In the project that we have, in which we've involved all the children in a dual language project, the attitude is changing among the students as well as the parents.
Which way?
For support.
For
support of the dual language project. I think that when you have limited experiences, and especially if you've never traveled outside of the U.S. and you're not aware, and if, you know, people never point out the fact that most diplomats that come to the United States from another country, they all speak English, but our diplomats that we send out everywhere speak only English. I mean, it's just a fact that is not... that is not publicized, and it's not said often enough. But I think that the numbers are here. The fact that we have, you know, television in Spanish, too strong, Univision and the other big channel. I can't remember what the other name is. But when you see all the programming that is going into into television and radio, you understand that there is another language. There's multi-language. I mean, we have 4 bilingual programs in Austin: Korean and English, Chinese and English, Vietnamese and English, and Spanish and English.
But what are the numbers of Chinese and
they're minimal. And the Vietnamese are growing, and they're the second largest group. Probably make up about maybe 7%.
They're more than Koreans?
Oh yes, the Koreans and the Chinese that we have are basically students, children of students that are coming to study here at the university.
I thought there was like 30,000 Koreans in Austin, more than Vietnamese.
Oh no.
There's more Vietnamese.
There are more Vietnamese. Yes.
What are the numbers?
There's probably, we're serving approximately maybe 1,000 children in the Vietnamese program. In the Chinese program, we have about 30 students.
Koreans,
we have probably about also about 30. Yeah, they're small numbers. But by state law, we have to provide any time we have 20 students at any one grade level.
All right, well, let me switch tracks all together on you here and begin kind of to wrap this up. There are some people who are suggesting that the Razón de Party or a third party be revived. What is your take on that, or are you even electoral anymore?
It's been difficult for me to vote in the last elections. I all my life I felt I have never had a choice except the time that I was working and voting Razón Unida. I don't think that neither the Republican nor the Democratic Party offer any kind of platform that I can really support. There's a few, I get involved maybe in a few local elections, and they're usually with candidates that support the environment, environmental issues. That's probably my biggest one of the concerns that I have now. I think that any time any new movement evolves, that it is necessary. I mean, I think that everything is cyclical, and there has to be a continuous approach to diversifying and to meeting the needs of everyone that and how they think. And I don't think with a two-party system we get that diversity. We don't get enough. We don't even get the issues anymore clearly stated. Because all the issues sound so alike that all the players do not even begin to discuss the issue from various points of views. So the complexity nor the diversity of our political system is in place. And for me, as our society becomes more and more diverse, and as I look at the issue, especially of recent immigrant students, who are actually used as a scapegoat to solve all the other issues. Everything is so simplistic. And so for me, I think it's essential that you do have more parties in the arena, simply because you get more perspectives, and you also really get a complexity of what our society really, really reflects. And I don't think a two-party system will ever begin to meet the needs nor the positions of what our society is becoming very, very quickly, and that is, a multi-ethnic society and a society that is predominantly will be of color and definitely have a very different point of view.
What are the most pressing issues for the Mexican-American community?
I think education still is at the forefront of the issues, definitely health and job opportunities without education. Of course, the job arena becomes very, very narrow. I think that is the health, to me, the fact that most people do not have a health plan and are not able to afford one, and it's not part of the benefits anymore of most jobs. I think that definitely is going to be a major issue for most Latino, Latinas, or Mexican American community. And the other thing, I think that all of us need to focus on the environment. I think we're poisoning ourselves. The Sierra Blanca project that is right there in near Nuevo Mexico, I mean, El Paso, definitely will affect most of our people. The water in New Brunswick and all over. I mean, New Mexico also, the toxins in the water and in the, you know, the food we eat, and what we consume, and our knowledge about that is needs to be ever on an increase. So I think those are going to be, you know, critical issues.
Most effective leaders that are Mexican-American at whatever level, just point out to me which level you're talking about.
Effective leaders. That is a difficult one, because I don't think clearly they're not surfacing. They're just not at a point where they have, I guess, the public image or the visibility. And unfortunately, in this country, we're so dependent on mass media. And if mass media doesn't pick up, you know, a public figure, they're basically not known. And so it's almost difficult for me to even begin to name. I don't think I can.
The underpinnings of tension between blacks and browns. Why are these two groups increasingly getting hostile toward each other?
I think. You know, during the time that we were working with Trasanida, there was an effort to bridge that gap, to dialogue, to recognize the fact that many of the issues facing Afro-Americans were the same issues that we were trying to struggle and change. And, you know, I feel like that dialogue between the Mexican-American community and blacks has not continued. It has not continued at many levels. I think most of us, I mean, we even see those rifts even among our own people. You know, recent immigrant people are looked down upon, native-born Mexicanos here. I think many human beings are looking for easy answers and easy solutions, and there are none. And I think I think it's easy for people to tag a certain group to put blame on them. I think that we're each community, both the Mexican American community and the black community, are facing some of the same issues of drug and alcoholism and teenage pregnancy and violence, not only among ourselves but against each other. Gang activity is definitely something that faces both communities, and I think the isolation as well as even our own communities are not together. I mean, I see a lot of strife even within the Mexican-American community. There's not the same unity nor the same discussion. There's no, there hasn't been a forum, actually.
I think forum?
A forum to discuss,
forum
to discuss issues. I mean, even among Mexicanos, at least when we were, when Raza Unida was there, there was at least a dialogue between mass media and the position of the party, or between the party and, let's say, the other major parties. But now, you know, in the last few years, there's been no discussion. There's been no meeting of the minds. There's, other than what local groups are doing to try to help Afro-Americans and Mexican-Americans to you know, to begin and see how we are connected and how we can help with change, but no one is doing the work. I mean, I don't see anyone doing the work.
Well, the second to the last question is related, and you've already started talking a little bit about it, but it's very precise. Just like the thing on blacks and browns, within the brown groups, mm-hmm. Chicanos, Puerto Ricans, Chicanos, Cubans, mm-hmm. Chicanos, Nicaraguans, Chicanos, mm-hmm. Salvadorans, mm-hmm. what are the underpinnings there of discord? How come we give lip service to being Latinos and Hispanics, but right. we don't live it? What's the problem?
Our problem is human beings, I guess. It's always easier to blame someone for your discomfort, or for your hopelessness, or for your disenchantment and your trouble. It's just an easy thing to do. I mean, scapegoating is something that I think at all levels, it's done.
Because if that's the case, why don't we turn and blame the gringo for everything? Why do we blame someone that's kind of like us? What's the deal?
Well, I mean, it's whenever we see a difference, it's easy to, if we see a difference, we think that that's the person that is the cause of all our problem. I think too is that we haven't learned to connect, you know, with people as human beings. We still seem to emphasize the differences instead of the similarities, and many times, you know, and there are, I mean, some differences, and I mean, I think with even the Latinos, I think we can definitely see that the Cubans in Miami are very different and think very differently than I would say the Mexican workers in Texas. You know, I think we would be probably in opposite sides on some issues. But that doesn't mean that, you know, everyone would fall. And I'm getting to think that even among Mexican Americans, there is a swelling of conservatism, you know, of Latinos even looking at a more conservative position. Yeah, I think that there is that as people begin to feel comfortable economically, or that we, you know, human beings try to protect their interest and try to protect their interest from their point of view. And if they feel like conservatism will protect their advantage, economic advantage at this particular time, you know, they'll change. And I think that's probably true also for, you know, for other groups. I mean, they see that if it's to their interest, they'll take that position that they feel will protect their interest without looking at or exploring what is best for the total community or the total society. You know, people don't think in those diverse, nor do they think of inclusion. You know, you look at the whole issue of prisons, and it's very hard for people to even begin to stretch their thinking, and thinking that prisons is a solution, not understanding that you just can't maintain prisons and continue to lock up people. It just doesn't serve the purpose without change. But I think we're in a society that are at a time which we're looking for easy solutions, and so we grab the first thing that comes that seems to be appropriate and won't change, and we rarely get into discussion or into dialogue to fully understand any issue. And as long as we each stand in our corner and never really engage or listen, I don't think we're ever going to get to a consensus. We can't build a consensus that way.
Last question. What did I forget to ask you that you want to talk about?
At this hour of the night, I think you've asked me everything.
Okay. Well, you sure? Is there nothing to say?
No, I guess the thing that I would say is that in my struggle throughout, life, I think I'm always seeking answers. And although I think, people would say that I've gone through many phases and many changes, that ultimately we're all searching for better answers and for better solutions. And that, and so my hope is that the youth and those that will follow me will definitely have the spirit and the enthusiasm to be creative and to do what they feel like is most appropriate for the betterment of all society, not just for our self-interest, because I think that all of us in our struggles, and no matter what path we take, I think ultimately our goal is that we will create a better world, create better understanding, a more compassionate society, one that would celebrate life and not death. And so that's, my hope is that the generations that come after me will struggle with the same issues and the same problems that I've struggled with all my life and still struggling with. That I definitely don't feel like I've got any answers many times, but I don't give up. I mean, I think I continue this process, to bring new understanding, to bring new more compassion and I guess dialogue, because I think that's really where we can we can truly make a difference if we just continue to work with hope.
I said there was a last question, but you alluded to something repeatedly, and a couple times you said it very specifically. Is death so much around some real close personal people here that it's very present in your mind, or you have some premonition you're going to die here like 2-3 years?
No, I don't. I mean, I don't think I'm there's no guarantee that that I will live another 50 years. But I think that I have seen some of my friends die of AIDS, and I do have some women friends that have had double mastectomies and have had lupus and other diseases. And sometimes I really feel like we don't have a healthy way of dealing with death yet. And I think there is a way to deal with death in such a way that we can talk about it, and that we can, and that I want to be very clear with my nephews and nieces. I'm going to be able to talk to them now at this time, so that there'll be no questions as to what they will do with me after I die. I mean, I want them to know what I want in terms of ceremony or ritual that I want for me. And that's important to me. I mean, I think that's something that I think that for me, life is death and death is life. I mean, I see it as a cycle, a very integral cycle of the same thing. And I'm just now beginning to explore, I think, from the indigenous people of Mexico, I think definitely they have this concept of life-death connection that, you know, that we've kind of denied. And to me, it's healthier than never talking about it. And okay, that's just the way I think that I see things as people struggle with death, and sometimes at a very young age. I think what propelled me to seek out and understand it from the point of the position that while I'm still alive, I want to be able to understand it.
Well, I want to thank you for the amount of time that you've given us. As I said earlier, before I turned the camera on, is that not only is this a historical record that we've made, it's a biographical one and a very personal one. So in a sense, this also is your archive. Mm-hmm. So if there's anything that you want to send now or later, mm-hmm. Feel free to do so, regardless of whether I'm there or not. The mm-hmm. archive will be there. Mm-hmm. And approximately, maybe, you know, about a year or a little less, this will be transcribed, and you'll get a soft copy transcribed and mm-hmm. A copy of the video, and there'll be a presentation. Hopefully you can come. Mm. Maybe you'll be retired by then. So. But anyway, thank you again.